Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and welcome to Arts Roundup, where it's the season to be seen out and about, uplifted perhaps by the prospect of witnessing the very best in international film, or take a rare chance to radically rethink the art in your clothing, consider taking up photography, or brace yourself for some new and heart-wrenching theatre. In this edition, we preview the forthcoming film festival with Emily Boldy. Painter and clothes designer Brenda Mayo returns to Cambridge from France and offers a new take on how to make a feminine living artistic statement with the cut of your clothes. Helen Holgate introduces a new play, Kinder's Transport, that takes a child's eye view of the life of wartime child evacuees, coming up at Robinson Theatre. Photographers Mark Woods Nunn and Carl Dimitri Bishop talk on taking up photography and a new exhibition on the darker side of human nature at Cambridge Art Salon. And White House Art appeals for entrance for this year's Charity Arts Exhibition. If your head is just about ready for a really good imaginative shake-up of its contents, you're currently in just the place, as the 33rd Cambridge Film Festival gears up to screen possibly its best ever lineup of inspiring work from around the world. The Film Festival's team have been busily researching and producing an excellent cross-section of new and interesting work, and will welcome a host of industry insiders, directors and celebrities to give talks on their work in varied and breathtaking locations across the city. They'll also let audiences ask questions and vote for a festival best film. Film Festival Administrator Emily Boldy introduces the series, which kicks off on September the 9th and runs until the 29th. What marks this year's film festival against ones that you've worked on before?
This year's programme is actually the largest programme we've had to date. So there's even more films than normal, and we cover all sorts of films, no blockbusters, but big budget films, films that don't have distributors, films from all around the world.
Fantastic. And you've got some quite important shakers and movers visiting this year. Obviously, Stephen Hawking is a local celebrity icon in Cambridge. The film Hawking is being shown, and he's introducing part of that, isn't he, at some point?
Yes, there's going to be a... He'll be introducing it. There'll be a Q&A that was actually going to be broadcast to lots of cinemas across the country. It will be broadcast into screen one as well, because of the wheelchair accessibility. It'll actually be done on a smaller screen. But yes, there'll be a Q&A, and we're really looking forward to it.
You've got visiting directors. I gather that Kevin MacDonald is coming to introduce his film, How I Live Now. That there are a few others who are going to sneak in and out, aren't there, during the course of it?
Oh, absolutely. We've got... they're all in the process of being confirmed, but we've invited a lot of people to come from all over the world. Ones that we have confirmed that we're very excited about, for example, Roland Klick, who's a cult German director from the 70s and 80s. He'll be here for the screening of White Star, which is part of our showcase on his films, which haven't been seen very often in the UK. We have visiting filmmakers like Lucy Walker for The Crash Reel, Andrew Mudge for The Forgotten Kingdom. There'll be a Q&A for Back to the Garden, and Derek Malcolm will be doing that Q&A. So that's the interviewer is famous in himself. We have world premieres, we have UK premieres, and everybody that's coming, all the filmmakers, are generally very excited and really looking forward to talking to the public.
Now, you've got some hitherto largely unseen films coming to the film festival this year. Can you give me a pick of one or two of those?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredible. I don't know, I don't want to miss any of them out, because they're all so special. I think the ones we're excited about, there's the young Americans filmmakers. So that's young directors that are making films in different ways from Hollywood. So we've got a strand of that. We've got a showcase of Roland Klick's films, which haven't been seen often in the UK. Then we have national cinema specific strands, our German cinema strand, which is as a regular feature of the Cambridge Film Festival, because we have our international programmer also works for the Berlin Festival, so she's got insider's knowledge on the best films coming out of Germany. She's also programmed a strand called Eastern Views, which is about countries from Eastern Europe and the really interesting films that are coming out of them, and kind of the impact of communism on the cinema that they're producing now. Then we have the second year of the Catalan strand, Catalan cinema, for which we're coming to the film The Redemption of Fishes. We've got Iranian films, and then another strand that we're really looking forward to is our music documentary strand, which is packed full of a wide range of documentaries. And we're very lucky to have, we've got a film on Thomas Dolby, and he'll be coming to play a live set after the film. And then we've also got John Otway coming. So fans of those two musicians, it's definitely not to be missed. We also have our usual strand called Microcinema, which is actually, it's about budget filmmaking, which is out of the normal industry path. Mm. This one we're focusing on British eccentrics. Mm. It's the subtitle to the strand, particularly with the films of John Sampson, Mike Wallington, and John Peirce, who some people might have heard of. Mm. They're definitely different and daring and, yeah, maybe a bit naughty. Then we have our usual specially programmed selection of shorts. Those are a lot of films that have been submitted to the festival. Our shorts programmer watches over 400 films that have been submitted and then makes these five strands. And as part of the short, one of the shorts programs, we've got a short film, which is about 25 minutes long, but we're showing just by itself because it's so powerful, called Just Before Losing Everything. You can actually get in to see that for free if you have a ticket to any of the other short films. So we'd like people to go along to those. And then finally, we've got a couple of films that might interest the Cambridge audience in particular, which we've programmed in hand with Hawking film, which Particle Fever, the Lebanese Rocket Society, and Google and the World Brain. So those are kind of science subjects films with, and they'll have some visitors as well. So
a lot of decision making must have gone behind choosing that mix to make it a really highly spiced affair. What happened behind the scenes?
Well, we've got a team of programmers that work all around the year. They attend as many different film festivals as possible. Very big ones like Cannes and Berlin, Venice, Transylvanian Film Festival. And basically, they curate programs. They have areas of interest. And they then pick the best films that they find in these film festivals and curate the program specially for Cambridge. So, yes, it's great. So there's always going to be films that some people like more than others. They really, I mean, Tony Jones, the festival director, has the ultimate say, but the programmers do the work for their own strands.
It's great to have the BFI playing a part in the film festival, but not many people realise that the BFI have established themselves in the Central Library now, and they have a massive library of films that you can get into.
Yeah, no, it's not very well signposted, but it's an incredible resource that is in the Central Library, the BFI Mediatheque, where you can go and for free watch any film from the BFI back catalogue that's been digitised. And so you've got a wealth of British films, and you could spend hours in there, and it's all free. One thing not to forget about the BFI is that they're our main sponsors. So without the BFI and without the funding from the BFI, we wouldn't be able to do the film festival.
You do have a number of other sponsors as well. Who are they?
Yeah, we've got TTP, they're loyal supporters, Studio 24, that do our website, Cambridge Assessment, who have been supporting our outdoor screenings, Chevrolet that give us the festival cars, DeLuca that's our official festival restaurant, the City Council. Yes, there's a lot of support from a lot of groups.
Emily Baldy, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
Thanks. Thank you.
To tap into the festival programme and resources, go to camfilmfest.com for your web connections. If you're a woman of parts and have the confidence to try something a bit daring and new by way of designer clothing, why not experiment with sculptural clothing made by an artist that's both a living and moving art form and something comfortable that reflects your inner profile? Artist and clothes designer Brenda Mayo has recently returned to Cambridge from living and working in southwest France and discovered her artistic experiments with material took her in new directions, which simply have to be explored because of their feminine and tactile nature. Here I am in Mount Pleasant in the north of Cambridge at the top of Castle Hill in a rather splendid apartment with artist Brenda Mayo, who has recently returned from living a very stylish life in the south of France. Brenda, hello.
Hello. I wouldn't say stylish exactly. It was extremely remote and very rustic. but memorable.
What was the name of this wonderful village that you were living in? Because it's right up in the hills.
It has a very curious name of Davajan, and curious to the French in addition to the English. It's exactly halfway between Carcassonne and Perpignan.
And there you've been designing your clothing as well as being a painter.
That's right, yes. Well, I'll explain how I came to be devoting so much time to designing and making clothes. When I lived in Cambridge and taught here in Cambridge, I would make clothes after I finished the teaching term and before I could get going again with my painting. So I would sit at the sewing machine with my thoughts in the studio, but sewing and handling material, which is what I particularly like doing. And when I went to France, the interface between teaching and retiring was a significant scale. So I started devoting more and more time to the business of handling fabrics and making clothing, and in fact found in a brocante, as it's called, like a kind of flea market, say, a huge bolt of old French linen. And I used this French linen to invent a garment which I found a link to the world of the Cathars within. The Cathar castles are very prominent within that zone of France where I was living, in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And so I had the lifestyle of the Cathars kind of lingering in the back of my mind. And I made this very rustic, very oddly shaped garment, which for me had some sort of resonance with the medieval period. And after some months, I discovered that painting hadn't quite got going again, and I was still making the clothing and beginning to invent all sorts of quite interesting shapes.
Was there a moment when the art and the clothing just came together and you evolved into something new?
It became sculptural. The clothing was less to do with painting, as it was my principal background, but much more to do with sculpted forms. And I also have a bit of a background with dance, and the idea of how one moves when wearing clothing began to determine to some extent how I manipulated the fabric, what sort of fabrics I chose to work with, and so on.
So you were given this great impression by the surroundings, and then you effectively made living art within them.
In a way, yes, one could say that. Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. Yes, so things that have a life of their own, even when not being worn. Things that you could actually enjoy seeing hanging on the wall, perhaps.
Looking at your clothing, it is wonderfully bright. It's very, very bold. It's very, very tasteful. And it has a lovely aesthetic. Does that translate to a place like Cambridge, do you think, when you take it out of that context?
Well, to pick up on the idea that your mention of the colour and so on, that particular element is stimulated by my enthusiasm for kimonos and Japanese traditional garments, where you notice the most extraordinary combination of pattern and colour. Very small checkered fabrics with lucid and curvilinear floral designs, reference to the natural world, to plant forms and insect forms and so on, all coming together within a particular garment, a single garment. For example, a kimono, which is a very, very simple shape, bringing together all these patterns and textures. How that relates to Cambridge, that's an open question.
They seem to have, I mean, they're black and white in a kind of oriental way, but they have a kind of a crispness that go with feelings of feeling comfortable with yourself, for inner peace, and feeling relaxed, bright, and happy in the way that many oriental art.
Do you mean black and white in the sense of that graphic,
yes,
very graphic sense?
Yes,
that
I
they
do,
have,
definitely.
Not necessarily black and white in terms of colour.
Yeah.
I think one has to have a certain degree of, we'll say, confidence, certainly comfort within the garment, because it has its own identity. It has a characteristic quite distinctive. And if one feels hesitant about carrying off something which is quite striking, then one might have to wait for the right moment. One wakes up some mornings and feels, you know, you just want to hide. Other days you feel, oh, I'd like to be enveloped in that kind of sculpted form.
You have to be quite daring to wear clothes that are a bit out of the ordinary. Is that a thing about, when you mentioned confidence, but it's also about having a certain kind of maturity, isn't it?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. Yes, because I think youngsters tend to, they need to be similar to their peer group. Yeah. As one matures, then there's a, one takes on a confidence about one's personal identity.
And obviously, French clothing, that they do, they do have a flair for femininity, don't they, in
they
the clothing?
Do,
and you've
they
been
do.
Learning from that, haven't you?
I have been learning from that, but what I've actually learned is that the French can be quite conservative. They have a certain degree of chic, but I wouldn't say that they naturally tumble to something that's as innovative and individual as the things that, I'm making.
Can you take me through the process of once you become inspired and you get an idea for something, how does it come together into one of your items?
I have a huge collection of fabrics, and the manner in which it works is something like this. The fabrics are like a palette of colour, and I keep everything as visible as possible, which actually necessitates a certain level of chaos. And I seize on combinations of texture and colour and bring those together. That's often, the colour and texture is very often the springboard. Then I have a mannequin stand, rather beautiful, it's about 80 years old, what's called a Stockman, which is a brand name. Is a magnificent Edwardian form, and I drape the fabrics around the form and discover how the fabrics move and how they want to fall and how they sit comfortably or not with each other. I might have to make some radical changes. So I'm experimenting with the forms as I go along. The forms emerge from the quality of the fabrics.
Is this very much about creating that? I mean, some of your costumes have large folds in them, they have very bold designs. Mm-hmm. They have lots of ruffles and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that gives you very much a sense of being female as well, isn't it?
That's an interesting observation. And they're fluid. Yeah. But not always. Yeah. I've also worked with a fabric that's that I actually found in Paris, and it's a quite rigid fabric, and people love it. It's not that easy to wear. It has a certain degree of rigidity, so which is much more, in a way, can lend itself to something slightly military in a curious way. But it also has a lovely sound, and it rustles, and I think that might be the female within the fabric.
You also paint. Obviously, the paintings you do are wonderful abstracts. Mm-hmm. They're very pleasing to the eye. I mean, I have to say that they have lovely aesthetics. They have a kind of a faded feel about them. Can you tell me about those? Because they're things like fountains, birds, and flowers, and abstract shapes. How do those work?
Well, to go back, when I first started painting, I was making very, it's always been abstract, but it was much more closely linked to German abstract expressionism and very bright colours. And there came a point at which I decided, you know, the level of colour almost exhausted itself, and I thought, right, I'm going back to something much more spare and elemental. I spent some time in the desert in Israel, also in Morocco, and in that time I became very, very absorbed by the minimal colour of the sand colour, the greys, the stone, the Hamada of Morocco, very subdued elemental colours. And so I tossed out all the colour in the painting and started making these very minimal abstracts with very little colour. With hindsight, I can see now, this is work I was making in the 90s, they're just like textiles. They have such a striking resemblance to veils of very translucent fabric.
And you're trying to get down to a sense of humble purity, in them, which is great. And the themes of purity and regeneration are very important to you, aren't they? As well as having some connotations of religious backdrop to that as well.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the enclosed garden of the Virgin Mary, a very specific location. To do with fecundity and certainly regeneration, and the reference to the natural world, the abundance of flowers, of insects, of birds. Hmm. I think that links back to my interest in the motifs of the Japanese textiles tradition.
Are you working on new clothing and new paintings at the moment?
New clothing.
Yeah.
And an idea to introduce visual elements that I have created within the clothing.
Hmm.
But that's in parentheses at the moment. That involves a certain amount of technical assistance, so I'm holding back on that.
Are you having any shows or exhibitions in Cambridge in the next few months?
Future. Certainly at some point next summer. I'll be showing in London at some point towards the later part of this year. Well, we're already in the last 6 months. And I'll be showing my work at Persephone Books in Lamb's Conduit Street in London.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a vernissage, an opening in the museum in Denmark in October, but nothing specific to Cambridge. Mm-hmm. At
but
the moment.
People can follow you on your website.
That's true.
Can you give me the web address for that?
www.brenda-mayo-design.com.
Great stuff. And obviously, to cap it all off, you have another talent, which is that you're a musician. You're currently learning to play the cello.
Yeah.
So,
debutant.
Can we hear a little bit of cello?
I will try.
Okay. The nightmare of being separated from your family during the Holocaust of World War II was a real-life drama few could fully appreciate nowadays in its life-changing magnitude. I've been hearing about a new play set to be staged at the Robinson Theatre in Hills Road on the 14th and 15th of October, whose protagonist is a 9-year-old Jewish girl called Eva, who's smuggled out of Nazi Germany and sent to England to an uncertain future as one of a group of 10,000 children. Kinder's Transport is an emotive play performed by the combined actors of Cambridge and looks set to attract considerable interest. The production team's Helen Holgate is an actress, mother of two, and also a former Addenbrookes Hospital nurse. She plays Eva's mother, Helga. Helen, first of all, tell me about the combined actors of Cambridge. Who are they and what do they do?
We are a production company. We are a committee which invites directors to present the plays that they would like to direct. As a committee, we read the plays that they submit, we listen to the director and their ideas for their production, and then as a committee we decide what really we'd like to support. It's lovely because we get to support directors to maybe choose plays that aren't as well known and that wouldn't usually be seen on an amateur stage.
And what was your last production?
Last production was The Killing of Sister George, which was on at the ADC, and was a fantastic production.
Okay, now we've come here to talk about Kinder's Transport.
Yes.
That sounds like a very interesting and very emotive project. Can you tell me a bit about it?
Yeah, certainly. Kinder's Transport. It's written by Diane Samuels, and it's telling the story of one girl, Eva, who was one of the, you know, it's a fictional story, but it's based really, on the true accounts of the Kinder Transport. In the year preceding the Second World War, approximately 10,000 Jewish children were evacuated from Germany. The life had become extremely difficult for the Jewish population. There was pretty much a free-for-all from the Nazis on the Jewish people. And luckily, you know, thankfully, Great Britain agreed to take in as many sort of the Jewish children as they could. And 10,000 children got out before the outbreak of the Second World War.
It's a parent's ultimate nightmare, isn't it? Having their child removed from them, presumably in this direction to a safe place. But that was one of the biggest dramas of the Second World War, wasn't it?
Yes, really? I mean, how as a parent do you make that decision? Mm. And how awful must life be, and how big must that threat be that you take that choice to send your child away to a completely different country where a lot of them wouldn't even have known the language, they wouldn't know anyone out there, and they had to fight hard to get their places. They had to actually have a £50 bond to even do it, and get their sort of temporary visas all in order. So the 10,000 that did were actually very lucky. I believe it was about 1.5 million. Children that died in the camps. So 10,000 very lucky children.
Obviously an incredible ordeal for them to go through and a heart-wrenching tale, but it also created all kinds of strange relationships and experiences as well. I mean, I was recently watching a veteran of the Second World War who was saying that, in fact, when complete strangers take you in and help you in dire situations, it creates an amazing bond between you and those people who start off as strangers and then become completely part of your life.
That's just the thing. I mean, it changed the direction of so many families. And Kinder Transport really does deal with that sense of loss and that sense of separation and that sense of identity, and how that then translates not into just your generation, but into the generations that follow that.
Can you tell me about some of the highlights of the play? These are presumably children living off their wits.
I mean, it is a very emotive, very, very emotive play. And it has some lovely moments. It has some real humour. And you know, obviously, undercurrent is the mother-daughter relationship. I mean, there are some lovely moments with Ava, sort of as you see her trying to adjust to her new life in England, and you sort of see some of the, you know, the unthinking attitudes and everything that a lot of the people at the time did have. Even though these children were brought over into safety, there was still obviously a lot of uncertainty about these children that were in the end from Germany. And you know, you've got to be quite a strong character really to get through that.
And also, obviously, there were the unlucky ones who had to suffer the rat catchers of Nazi propaganda.
Well, there is actually the theme of the rat catcher that runs through Kinder Transport. It started in our young little girl Ava's mind when her mother Helga, who I play, reads her on her last night the rat catcher story, which is what Ava wants, not really the kind of story her mum wants to read to her, but you know, children.
What is the rat catcher story exactly?
Well, the rat catcher, it's like this, the sort of Pied Piper of Hamelin, and it's where he basically takes all the children, you know, he leads the children away.
It is that fairy tale.
But in Kinder Transport, then the rat catcher takes on somewhat of a mythical role, and he represents everyone's deepest, darkest fears, which for Ava is that she is going to be taken away.
So who are the main characters? Ava is the protagonist, is she?
Ava is the protagonist, we've got a lovely young actress, Amelia, who's playing her, and she starts off the play at 9 years old in Germany, and obviously then goes over to England, and Amelia finishes playing her when she's 17 years old. Then I play Helga, who is Ava's mother, who obviously has the heartbreaking decision to send her away and try and prepare her for that journey. There's also Lil, who is the lovely foster mother that takes Ava in. And then there's a shift somewhat in the story, in the timeline, where the play sort of jumps to the 1970s, and we actually see Ava grown up, turned to Germany.
Does this play take you off in a direction that people haven't seen before?
I think it does. Mm. I'm going to be completely honest. Before I started doing Kinder Transport, I'd never heard of the Kinder Transport. I'd never heard of these Jewish children that had been rescued before the Second World War, and I've never sort of seen another play or another film that has looked specifically at that separation and at that child's journey, and how that continues, that loss and that separation continues to affect not only her, but her, you know, the generations that follow as well.
Kindertransport, it sounds like an absolutely fabulously interesting play. Helen Hurlgate, thank you very much indeed for telling us about it.
Thank you very much.
You don't have to own an expensive camera to have the minerals to take up photography seriously, just a will to see things differently. That's the advice of Cambridge photography teacher Mark Woods-Nunn, who's currently running a new set of workshops starting this September. He joined me with Carl Dimitri Bishop, a photographer about to open a show at Cambridge Arts Salon, exploring the darker side of the human psyche and opening with a private view on September the 6th.
Mark, you're about to do something interesting. Tell me what it is exactly. You're showing the products of a workshop that you've been running, is that right?
Well, we're actually going to have an exhibition at the end of October, which is based upon work that I've had from students over the last year or so. Various different types of work in terms of photography, different levels of experience as well.
Now, in the past, you were doing things like photographing people who had some traumas in their lives and things like that. Some really incredible images that you got there where you caught them at the moment of recovery, when the spirit and the wind came back into them. Yeah. What have you been doing since then with your photography?
Okay, so what's coming up is much more of a mixed bag. This is open to anyone. Mm. It's angled for complete beginners. We're going to walk through the basics of photography, a little bit about the history. But the idea is that someone can come along to that, know next to nothing, and at the end of it be able to produce some kind of quality work that could be shown in an exhibition piece.
There's lots of different directions people can take their photography in once they have those basic skills, aren't there? Can you tell me a little bit about the range of different things that people can pursue, as it were, if their interest takes them one way or another?
Okay, so we can go from real abstract macro work, making the everyday mundane look really interesting, down to personal issues, talking to people, which is kind of my side of photography, down to landscape and urbanscape. So it's a bit of a mix, really. The exhibition that will be shown later at the end of October will display that. So there'll be people who I've taught previously who will have a very mixed approach, but all will have gained some confidence. They've come from, very basic to almost advanced.
Is it a good idea to have a theme in mind when you come to a project like that, that you already have some idea of the kind of thing that you want to do, be it street photography, be it the more glamorous side of life or any other side of life? Is it a good idea to have like one thing going on in your mind when you start off and then use that as your kind of starting point? Or
absolutely. I mean, it can be very helpful. I think often putting limitations on us stimulates creativity. Sometimes people think, well, where on earth do I start? So it's good to have a focus point, and then sky's your limit. You go away with it however you want to.
So describe the induction session. What happens at one of those?
Well, we put blindfolds on. Induction session, it's more, I start off with people telling me what they think makes a good photograph and what is photography, and from there usually we have like a huge discussion and get an idea for where people are coming from, because me mostly have different opinions, different approaches.
It's not necessary, is it, to have a particularly good camera to be a good photographer?
Absolutely not. No. You've seen previous work we've done. We've done stuff with beer cans. So it's really knowing what makes a good image. Obviously, the more technically advanced a camera is, you would tend to have more control and you can achieve different effects. But ultimately, in terms of photography, you as the photographer is the most important thing, followed by the subject matter.
Okay, what's this event going to show and where is it? Where can people come along?
Okay, so the actual workshop starts on the 30th of September, and people can just get in touch with me and do that. The actual exhibition starts on the 31st of October, so a month or so afterwards.
Great, a great opportunity to get into photography and learn what it's all about. And Carl Bishop, you are about to open a new exhibition at Cambridge Arts Salon, and you have a theme that's perhaps a little bit unexpected. What is that?
A darker theme. Fairy tales, the unexplained, things that go bump in the night.
So it's things that spook you, basically.
Yeah, people fear what they don't understand, and that's what I like, the mystery.
Did you find in your childhood that those things interested you particularly? I mean, what's under the bed? What's behind this wardrobe? The wardrobe door. What if there is a wicked witch out there or whatever? Is it that kind of inspiration?
Definitely. Yeah. When I was a kid, it was my favourite thing. Whenever I got taken to the cinema to see a Disney film, for example, The Little Mermaid, like Ursula was my favourite character because she was evil and
So can you tell me a bit about some of the images that are going to be there in your exhibition?
There's going to be a collection of images over the last couple of years. This is my first show, actually, so it's going to be a collection of all different types of things I've been working on. Lots of different themes there.
So those are mainly sort of eerie things, are they? Yeah.
Local legends, for example, the Gogmagogs, the buried gods, lots of Cambridge-related stuff as well.
And how do you capture that in a photograph? I mean, what do you try to do?
What do I try to do? First of all, I like to read up about what I want to take photos on. And then I use lots of different magical items to try and create the different style of photos.
And do you just like notice things that you think, gosh, that might unnerve somebody, you know, and then explore it? Is that something you do a lot?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's at Cambridge Arts Salon. What's the actual dates for that?
That's on the 6th of September. That's the private view that starts at 6:30. And then it runs till the 18th of September, so it's on for 2 weeks.
How did you get involved in photography in the first place? Were you at a session like Mark Woods and Anna's just described? How you got into it?
Or? I actually did a session at Hills Road a couple of years ago. It was very good. You should all attend. It's something I just fell into. I've always enjoyed taking photos. I've always been good at art at school. It was the only subject I enjoyed, really. I went to China a couple of years ago and took loads of good photos, and it's just started from there, really.
And spine-chilling things, do you try to actually invoke a bit of fear in people?
Yeah. My main interest is you take a photo and you can't quite tell or put your finger on what it is. But then people see different stories in it, which is quite interesting.
And who are your subjects normally, typically?
Normally my friends, because they understand what I want, and it's just like a chilled environment, and we all kind of run around and mess around. It's kind of fun.
And what are the showpieces, the highlights, the photographs you're most proud of?
That's a different question. There's All the Lovers, which is the new series I've worked on, which is a bit like a self-portrait, really, collection. And they're pictures of me.
Pictures of you, So if people want to get in touch with you, they want to engage with this photography, where do they go?
Okay, you can contact me on my email address, which is mjwoodsnun@gmail.com, or give me a call on my mobile, which is 07709446647. There will also be something in the Art Salon as well.
Okay, great. And you?
Again, the Cambridge Art Salon website is a good place to visit, and also www.carldimitribishop.com.
Must have a look at that. Thank you both very much indeed for coming in to tell 105 about your projects. That's great.
Thank you.
If you fancy having a go at your very first piece of artwork, or keeping your hand in as something of a past master, or perhaps a feeling philanthropic as an established artist, you're being invited to take part in a charity art exhibition. Founder of Independent Arts Centre White House Arts, Caroline Amory, has been showing me some early entries to Magic of the Ordinary, a fundraiser for local charity Rowan and SOS Children's Villages taking place at Chesterton Community College in mid-November. She's appealing early for entrants to make something unique and donate it before November the 4th.
Here I am at White House Arts on the river on Stourbridge Common, a beautiful white house looking out over the river. And in front of me are some very interesting canvases. I'm here with Caroline Amory, and we've been looking at some rather wonderful canvases, which are a precursor to something a bit special. You're building up towards an art exhibition in Chesterton in November. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes, a couple of years ago we did a similar exhibition, and to our delight it was a great success, and we raised over £11,000, and all the proceeds went to SOS Children's Villages in Zambia. We've always supported them, and we knew that they were building a village in Chipata in Zambia for AIDS orphans, and we wanted to give a slightly more substantial contribution. And because we have a lot of fun here, we thought we'd like to share some of the excitement with children.
Now you're currently appealing for people with an interest in this to take part in it and do something specific. What is it that you're asking people to do?
What we're doing is we're asking anybody, and this is non-selective, anybody who wishes to buy a canvas from us, which is 12 inches square, and do whatever they want upon it, either painting or drawing or anything sculptural, using ceramics or metal,
anything at all, as long as they keep within the 12-inch frame. You can take the canvas off and use the space in between, or use it as a little shelf, or whatever you want to do. But we then sell it. We're hoping to have this exhibition in November, 16th and 17th of November, at Chesterton Community College. And all the canvases are sold for a flat rate of £45, whether people are experienced, local artists, or whether people have never done it before. And it's always done anonymously, so nobody has their name up on it, although the purchaser can find out who they've bought from by looking at the back once they've got it from the wall.
The title of the exhibition is Magic of the Ordinary, isn't it? What does that mean exactly?
Well, this was a title, the last title was World of Difference, and the idea is to have a very general theme which people can hang their ideas on, perhaps trigger some very loosely common theme. And we chose Magic of the Ordinary because perhaps we feel that one of the aspects of art which we like to promote here is the sort of transformational, you know, the transforming side, so that things that seem very ordinary can be made to look magical, or ideas that seem to be very pedestrian can have a different slant on them. And so we thought it was a general, it's slightly tickling kind of title.
Okay, we've got four entries in front of us here. Can you just take us through what they are? They look absolutely wonderful. You've got a beautiful, very, very colourful portrait there. Do you know who that's of?
Yes, that actually was sent in by somebody from the West Country, because we have quite a wide range of people. And he's a photographer, and he's taken a picture of a very famous local drummer from Bristol, and he's managed to incorporate it with a very subtle small red square, and the picture's called Red Square.
And then you've got some very wacky things. You've got something with Lego there put onto a canvas.
Yes.
Which looks rather amusing. Some Lego figures. Lego men, do you call those?
There's a little Lego men. In fact, I think the ordinary is really sweetly characterised by these little Lego and the way it's put on there is magical. It's very unusual, and I think it's very striking.
Why are you helping Rowan? Because that's a very interesting charity as well, isn't it?
Well, Rowan is a local arts charity which provides a safe and creative and a unique environment where learning disabled adults, under the direction of artists, that's the important thing, and craftspeople who are skilled in their own right, can thrive and grow themselves artistically and contribute to a larger project or their own artwork. So it's a very, and it obviously it will then increase their self-esteem and is quite often a bridging towards a job, a simple job in the community, because they come on their own steam, they join in, and a lot of their work is sold. In fact, Anglesey Abbey has all their signage done by Rowan students, and there's lots of there's various churches around the area who use their beautifully carved artifacts for decorating their churches.
It's a wonderfully positive charity, isn't it?
Very positive, a wonderful ethos there. And we're very honoured that we can help them.
It sounds like it's going to be a really fabulous exhibition. Obviously, it's great to see some examples in advance, great artwork. I hope it's a huge success. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's time to take a brief look at shows coming up in the city in September. Agatha Christie's Mousetrap opens at the Corn Exchange on September the 16th, the longest running theatre show on earth. A group of people are trapped by snow in a country house, and murder most foul ensues. At the ADC Theatre, an adaptation of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure opens on September the 4th, but it isn't quite what it seems in terms of a sleaze backdrop and an American take on the play. Noel Coward's Fallen Angels, a tale of champagne-fueled revelry, opens at the Arts Theatre on September the 23rd. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you've enjoyed listening in to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.